The history of Dexter can be traceable to the latter part of the year 1877, when some members of the Columbus Street, now First Baptist on Ripley Street Church, withdrew and organized another church. The first meeting of the group was held in the parlor of the residence of Samuel Phillips at 630 High Street. Subsequent meetings were held in a hall located on Market Street, now Dexter Avenue, between Lawrence and McDonough Street. The hall had previously been used as a slave trader's pen. Following the period of slavery, the pen was used as a site for a neighborhood Sunday school, which was a product of mission workers. Trustees of the church purchased the site on which the present structure stands on January 30, 1879, for the sum of $270. Initial work on the building began in 1883, with William Watkins, a member, serving as contractor and builder. Members shared their time, energy, and resources towards its erection. City employees who were paving the street discarded brick at the city dump, and the good people of Dexter hauled them away by the wagon loads to brick the church. One man's trash is another man's treasure. Those who were skilled in carpentry assisted with its construction. The first worship service was held in its basement in 1885. On Thanksgiving Day, 40 years later, the first worship service was held in its upstairs sanctuary. On June 30, 1974, the church was designated a National Historic Landmark by the National Park Service of the United States Department of Interior in view of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's leadership in the civil rights struggle. The meeting in which the decision was made to launch the bus boycott was held in the church basement on December 2, 1955, and Pastor King was a participant. He was later elected president of the Montgomery Improvement Association and directed the activities of the church. Subsequently, he organized the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and served as leader of an extended movement. On July 13, 1976, the city of Montgomery added the church to its list of designated historic sites. Landmark Foundation of Montgomery unveiled an historic marker on its site on June 22, 1980. As tour manager of this magnificent historic building, I am deeply honored to tell your stories to the many visitors that come here. As a mother of three children, for about the same age as you wonderful, brave people were when you began your unprecedented journey, I can appreciate the fear and pride your parents must have felt while you were on your mission into unexplored waters. And I am committed to telling the entire wonderful and courageous story of your efforts. On behalf of Pastor Michael Thurman and the entire Dexter family, thank you for every effort and sacrifice you each made during that tumultuous period, and know in your hearts how grateful and humble we are to have such civil rights royalty in our home.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this second panel discussion. Freedom Ride 2007. I first want to let you know that after our panel discussion today, we will be going as a group across the street, out the door and across the street, up to the steps of the Alabama State Capitol, where John Siegenthaler, who was Attorney General Robert Kennedy's representative in this, and had quite an interesting run-in with the governor of Alabama in this building, will talk to us about that on the steps of the Capitol. We're also going to have that opportunity for all of us, as Nashville students and educators, we're going to have a group photograph taken on the steps of the Capitol with the Freedom Riders and Mr. Siegenthaler. I want to introduce our panel and the topic that we'll be talking about this afternoon. I asked Dr. Lafayette if he would moderate this discussion, and I wanted to ask them to talk about their day in Montgomery in 1961, but I also wanted them to talk about the theme of reconciliation, of what they would say to the people who met them with violence here in Montgomery in 1961. I would also point out that it's in this sanctuary that Governor George Wallace, who stood in the schoolhouse door, who, in his inaugural address across the street, talked about segregation today and segregation forever. It's in this room that he came as an old man to ask for forgiveness for his role in that. And the people welcomed him here. And I want to talk about the panel to talk today about that theme of reconciliation and what it means to move forward, taking those lessons from the past, but now moving forward in a positive way. So our panel will come up here to talk about this. Again, it's moderated by Dr. Lafayette. We should run about an hour. We'll probably wrap up around 3:30 or so, at which point we'll go across the street to hear Mr. Siegenthaler and have our photograph taken. And with that, I'll ask our panel to come up.
We have been traveling together, and I'm sure all of our participants have already been introduced to our panelists. And those who haven't, perhaps have read about them because they have been well documented. So I will dispense with the formal introductions and get right down to the topic since we have about an hour. I'd like to get more questions in because I'm realizing that the people who do have questions, and we get a chance to do that also. The first part of our panel discussion is going to be that day in Montgomery when the Freedom Rides actually arrived. And I want those who were on the ride that came into Montgomery to talk about what that experience was like. And we have the appropriate people who can tell you about that. And we also have, I don't think it's been mentioned, but actually Diane was one of the national coordinators for the Freedom Ride along with Martin Luther King and I think maybe Jim Foreman was there. But so far as we are concerned, she was representing, you know, the students. And I would like for her to share what it was like when she was involved in trying to coordinate the Freedom Rides and what sort of issues that she had to deal with, and how decisions that had to be made, and also the outcome of that. John Lewis and Jim Swerd want to talk about the arrival at that bus station and what things were like. And we also should be aware, this is a very interesting panel, by the way. I mean, I know all these people, but it's fortuitous. Because you see, Reverend C.T. Vivian and a group of ministers from Nashville joined us once we faced the mob in Montgomery. These were the older Freedom Riders, not the students. These were our teachers who came to back us up. And it's just sort of emotional when you think about it. They're the ones who made sure that they had our backs, even though we led the front. And they went with us all the way to Parchment, Mississippi. So it's something to have your teacher join you and be with you all the way through the event. That was one of the reasons why it was so successful, because even in Nashville, those who were our seniors, maybe 10 years older, gave us encouragement and support. So we didn't feel like we were radical students, okay? We were simply following the teachings and implementing those along with them. They were with us, and that made all the difference. So we have a formidable team here in terms of personalities and experiences and different roles in the movement and the Freedom Rides. And it's very fortunate that we have this. So, why don't we start out talking about what it was like that day that you arrived in Montgomery, like for John and also John Singenthaler, because he was the forerunner. He was actually here before we were, really, in Montgomery, trying to make sure we had safe passage coming through. So maybe we ought to start with John telling us what he was doing to prepare the way for us, and then we'll talk about those who arrived, okay? And then what Diane was doing to coordinate things, okay, and giving us the backup that we needed, along with bringing other students into the on the Freedom Ride to continue it. John?
Sure. I thank you, Bernard. I have been sent down by the Kennedy administration to try to help the first wave of Freedom Riders get from Birmingham to New Orleans. They had decided, some of them were so badly mangled from the assaults that 20 afternoon, that they could not continue the bus ride, and so they were going to take a plane. Problem was there were bomb threats, and so I had to negotiate with the Delta Airlines people. We got on there that night safely, and the last thing I think either the President or the Attorney General expected was that there would be another wave of Freedom Riders. But of course, Diane had them on the way in no time, and when the Attorney General discovered that, he said, get back up there and try to help them. They're bound to wind up in jail again. And so I did, and so they were. And so the period of a few days before Governor Patterson would give me an interview, and we talked about how to give them safe passage to Montgomery. And I came down in a private automobile from Birmingham and arrived. I had been, of course, with the governor a few days earlier and arrived just before. The buses arrived, clearly thinking that they had been assured safe passage, safe conduct. I thought in getting the first wave of Freedom Riders to Louisiana, I'd been so successful. I was sort of patting myself on the back, and now I had arranged safe passage, and of course, by nightfall, I felt a total failure because the whole thing had fallen apart, and they had been mauled and they mangled and distorted. And it was a, for me, it was a sad and depressing afternoon.
Diane, you were kind of overseeing these students coming in and the caravans of people. And after we were released from Birmingham and headed down, tell us what was going on and what kind of things you were doing and what was your experience.
First thing I wanted to say was, John, wasn't that the time you got hit in the head with a pipe and knocked unconscious?
It was.
You left that out.
It was. I can feel it still.
Well, I was in the Nashville office that was the coordination office. We had a very efficient operation there. And the national press had learned that they could contact the Nashville office and get up to the minute news. Our office was responsible for coordination between the various cities that by now were part of the Freedom Ride, press coordination, and coordination with the Department of Justice. We learned of the vicious attack that had taken place in Montgomery. People were seriously injured, but it was really frustrating because we couldn't tell exactly how badly people were injured. We could only hear news that people would describe to us. It was a busy time also because we were trying to recruit people from movements across the South and the North, really, to join the Freedom Ride so that we would have waves of people coming into the South. Oh, sorry, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? All right. That was a period of time where I started making decisions about whether I could do a better job of coordinating from Nashville or from Montgomery. And so very shortly I came into Montgomery. But there were still students in Nashville that kept the office running effectively. I remember visiting Jim Swerd and William Barbee in the hospital. I just learned yesterday that Jim didn't really remember that, but that's understandable. He was very injured. I remember he wore contact lenses at the time, and they had slipped off into the white of his eye, and he had these red circles where he had been beaten with contact lenses. And William Barbee, who was also in the hospital, had a cylindrical object, like I thought maybe a ballpoint pen, but someone said today that it was a piece of iron, a lead pipe. Well, it was tiny. It was really about this kind of size. Had that rammed into his ear, and so it was a very disturbing period. At the same time, the church was surrounded where we were met. Where we met later on, I think it may have been the same evening or the following evening.
Same
evening, yes.
Well, we had a small church, mm-hmm. not too far from the airport. That Saturday night, we met at First Baptist on Sunday.
Okay, and that was First Baptist that was surrounded.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I remember most about the night that the church was surrounded was that there was such a commitment on the part of the people in the church. It was surrounded and they were burning cars outside, and there was every reason to believe that the Klan was going to attack the church. And the thing I remember most about that night was the spirit of the people inside. We kept something going. Hour after hour after hour, freedom singing, or people would get up and talk and give inspirational speeches. But there seemed to be a commitment on the part of everybody to keep everybody else's spirits up and overcome the fear that people would have. Okay.
Thank you. We're going to come back, because Diane was part of the negotiation with sort of the Big Five, so to speak, and negotiated and trying to decide, you know, what we should do. So I want you to give some details on that. But that's really not been well documented yet. Unfortunately, she was the only student as well as the, woman who was involved with the Big Five there. So we want to get some more of that. But John,
sure.
I'd like for you and Jim to tell us what it was like when you arrived at the bus station coming from Birmingham. And then we're going to pick up and get CT to talk about what they heard and how they mobilized the Nashville Christian Leadership Council, and what was the, experience of coming down and that sort of thing. John?
Well, on Saturday, May 20th, we left Birmingham and arrived at the Greyhound bus station, a short distance from here, about 10:30 a.m. And as I said to some of you about that when we arrived at the station, it was so quiet, it was so peaceful, so orderly, it was so almost eerie. Diane and others, I think, had made arrangements for Bobby, William Bobby, and others to meet us. Bobby was part of an advance group to meet us. And there were people waiting to pick us up and take us to a particular place in the city. And most of the people couldn't make it to the station. We started down the steps of the Greyhound bus. And the moment we started down the steps, an angry mob just came out of nowhere. First attacking not us, not the Freedom Riders, but members of the media. If you had a camera, and during those days, the networks, the TV people had these big cameras that they, not the mini cam, and they were taking these cameras and just smashing them, knocking people down, and then turning on the pencil people, taking their pads. You saw reporters and photographers just bleeding all over the place. And then they turned on us. People had lead packs, bricks, stones, anything they could make a weapon. Men, women, young people. I wish it was possible for us to see how the courthouse, the old post office, and the bus station right together. Some of the young people were able to get down into the ladder and went into the post office. Several of the young African-American women were able to get in a taxi cab, was driven by a black cab driver. And some of the young white women tried to get in, and the black cab driver said, "I can't drive the cab. It's against the law in Alabama, in Montgomery, for blacks and whites to ride together in a taxi cab." And it was a young lady named Catherine Burt from Birmingham, who was a student at Tennessee State, told a cab driver to move over. She would drive the cab. But the cab driver drove off with the young black women and all of the young black men and Jim, who I believe at the time was the only white male in the group. We were left standing there, and the mob turned on us, started beating Jim and the two of us up against the wall. And we were left lying in a pool of blood. And it was Floyd Mann, the public safety director, that John Singerthal should say something else about, who came up and he pointed his gun straight up in the air and said, "There'll be no killing here today, there'll be no killing here today." And the mob dispersed. An injunction had been issued on the part of a judge, a state judge named Walter B. Jones, prohibiting CORE and other organizations and groups for traveling through the state of Alabama using public transportation in an interracial fashion. And we went into court and got that injunction lifted. Frank M. Johnson lifted that. That night, I think what happened that afternoon, Diane and Bernard, people were scattered all over the place, all over the city, different individuals. And we all had to call back to Nashville and speak to Diane to get the location where we were. And we finally met that Saturday night in a little church, tiny church near here. And Dr. King and Ralph Abernathy had been on a trip in Chicago, and they flew back to Montgomery. And that evening we started planning the mass meeting for the next day. Jim?
Yeah.
Thank you.
What was it like, Jim, when you arrived in Montgomery on that Saturday morning?
I was met with open arms. Fists were clenched, and they were holding stuff, but I was met with open arms. When they came from everywhere, and they came around the corners of buildings, they came out of the terminal itself, it was amazing how many there were. I know estimates say that it was around 1,000, I guess. And the thing that hit me initially was not just the screaming of, you know, get the Nayers, kill them, get them, but the absolute hatred in their eyes. After, I mean, I was beaten quite quickly, and very quickly I was unconscious. I remember waking up very briefly, and John handing me, I believe, probably your own handkerchief to wipe away some blood. And then I woke up and I was in the back of a moving vehicle, and I heard white Southern voices talking to me. And I knew I was being taken out to be killed or lynched. But then I woke up again, and I was in the emergency room, and William was there, and John was there, and for another 5 seconds, I maybe actually realized it was them before I passed out again. And then I did not really wake up for about a day and a half. So I was not aware of what was happening at the church. I don't know if I was really totally out for a day and a half, because before I went home, the nurse who took care of me came up to me and informed me that that night she had given me a knockout because she had heard that there was a mob that had gotten within a half a block of the hospital that were indeed coming to lynch me. And if they got there and made it in, she didn't want me to know what was going on. I also received the first flowers that I ever received in my life. Two women from Montgomery had gone to their own flower garden and picked flowers. And I don't know, you know, I'm not aware if they just hand delivered them or if they had them delivered, but they included a note that said, "We just want you to know that not everyone in Montgomery is like those that met you at the bus terminal." That's about what I remember.
Okay. I think that a strategic thing that I was interested in, I said I was going to come back to Diane because there had to be some critical decision about going forward, because the first part of the Freedom Ride had been met with violence. And of course, Jan mentioned that he was beaten actually in Carolina. Before the Freedom Rides ever met, got to Alabama, and that might be something to share. And at this point, the massive violence that had occurred at the bus station, there certainly had to be some discussion about whether it was safe to continue. So we wanted to look at that on several levels. The first level would be the leaders, and that would be Diane and Dr. Martin Luther King and those people who were overseeing the whole operation. And then I'd like for John Siegenthaler to talk about more specifically his negotiations and what were some of the discussion or comments or the position they were taking. Because after all, they arranged for that bus for us to come from Birmingham, the federal government, And so that was like, you know, we were in their hands. And then I'd really like for John to talk more about the safe house. Remember that house we were in? They said as long as we would stay in that house, okay, that would be a safe place for us, because they had warrants for our arrest. But before John talks, Singenthaler talks about that, I wanted CT to talk about how did the Nashville ministers respond. There's a little interesting detail I want to tell you. Dad was able to get them to sign the check so we could get the money to come down on the Freedom Ride. But there was one little problem. One signature was missing. So you couldn't really cash the check because that one signature was missing. So it was, where could we get a check cashed that time of night? So that was it $900? That was a lot of money in those days. And Leo Lillard knew some of the people who, they call them Nimbers, the Nimber Man. The Nimber Man was not a mathematician. But he would always have lots of actual cash. In the black community, we knew who had the cash, okay? Because it was not a cash register, you understand? It was not registered cash, in other words. Unregistered. So, the other ground. Okay, John called it the other ground. So we got the money with the understanding that when the other SCLC treasurer would get off from work, because he worked at night on the railroad, okay, that he would sign the check and then it could be cashed. And I'm trying to struggle with his name. We know him. John what? A lot of folks named John. What was his name? He was a graduate from American Baptist College. The one that was in jail that was trying to get us to say yes, sir, to the people. Don't you remember? And down there in Raymond, Mississippi? No, this was a local pastor, not too far from, okay. Yeah? Exactly, yes, okay. Well, his name will come to us before it's over. But in any event, he signed the check and that's how we got it. So on that level, okay, we want to talk about the ministers there in Nashville. And they had sent these students down there, had trained them, and now they ran into some serious violence and that kind of thing. What was your response, CT? Because we know you were one of those ministers who decided to come on down. Come on down.
The difficulty actually of the ministers was let's start at another point. Okay. You have to realize, and we've said this before, but it just has to be repeated because I don't think you understand. I don't think just hearing it once could help you understand what it meant if you were about to go into outright death, right? That you'd be surrounded by people that wanted to kill you. There wasn't two or three people. You'd be surrounded by it. When he said, it seemed like hundreds of people suddenly appeared. Figures went as high as 1,000. That's the kind of state Mississippi was, right? Is that they came to kill. And as you said, what you saw in their eyes was hatred. That's the thing that stood out. That's the thing that has to be understood, is that and here the group was really getting ready to go, and the ministers largely were older fellows with families, with responsibilities both for the church and for the family, and some of them had their children in school, all of this sort of thing, right? That is the baggage of the older. Let's call it a better word than baggage. You're thinking about baggage to your parents? No, I don't want you to think. these ministers had all these responsibilities, and the fear ran high on every count that it could be for family, for future, for their children, for their vocation, everything. So that it was a little harder to talk them into wanting to go. By the time we got through with it, though, there were about four or five fellows, I'm trying to think of their names, I'm like you with the fellow at the seminary, who came down and joined the group. Was one of them. Yeah, in fact, Metz is what I was trying to say, not to it immediately, but Metz Rollins. Anderson. That's about it. Yeah, it came later. That's about it, except for the fellow we're talking about that I remember so much, that near the seminary that we can't call his name, right? Is the, in fact, he's dead now. They all came down, and two go to jail, really, the idea was, will we have the same thing happen to us that happened before, was number one, to be beaten, right? Is that the second thing that was on people's minds as we came was, will we be jailed? The third thing was, in fact, we weren't even for certain what building we were going to. We knew that eventually we had to go to the station, but we did not want to do that until we had a lot more information. We went to a doctor's house. Went to a doctor's house. And by the time we got there, the real meeting was over. People had come from a number of places, and we were ready to go from there to the station. It was at the station that you see the pictures in most of the books. I don't want to go any further than you want me to go. That was the coming down, all right? But I want to tell you what I think happened to each one of the persons. Same thing that happened to me, which I mentioned last night anyway, is that you had to make certain that your family was together. And I mentioned to you last night is that without our wives, we could not have had a movement. And that's the most... that's the thing that is not written of at all. My wife did the book on Mrs. King Coretta, and I think the reason she did it was because it was a way of saying this is what all the wives went through, right? Is that she was using Coretta as the symbol for all the women of the movement, especially those that were in that inner circle. They had children. Had to keep them, had to worry about whether their husbands were going to die. My wife never, in fact, watched the 6 o'clock news. What was the problem? Problem was, is that you don't want to see the children see their husband beaten, their father beaten, right? And or anybody that anybody might know. That's a very, very important thing. The wife never got anything done until after the kids were put to school. We've had the Ku Klux Klan to march past our home. So you know that they knew not only you, but where you live, where your family was, where your children were, right? Now, those were the kind of problems that went in the heads of everyone going down. And I want you to understand that because the mothers and the wives were going to be left behind. That was a very serious kind of thing. How were they going to be kept up? There was no organization that could give them income. Came down and we were all there. We went into the doctor's home. The next thing I know, the pharmacist's home.
It was Dean Harris.
He was a Tuskegee Airman. Very successful businessman here in Montgomery. And not too many weeks ago, months ago, maybe about 3 months ago, a marker was put up at his house. So this is the place, and I'm not jumping ahead, CT, but this is the place
After we were forced to stay all night at First Baptist, and when the marshal and joined the Alabama National Guard that President Kennedy had federalized, the general came in and took over the mass meeting, the church, the service, and we all were transported, all of us, all of the Freedom Riders, Dr. King and Reverend Abernathy, all of us, to the former's house, to Dean Harris' home. It was a Tuskegee Airmen. And we all stayed there. And that's where Diane, some of the planning, some of the meetings took place right there in his home. The people came in and brought food and prepared for us during the days that we stayed there. And a few days later, Diane, Martin Luther King Jr., Ralph Abernathy, James Farmer, and myself held a press conference to announce that the Freedom Ride will continue. And we were escorted from the city of Montgomery, CT, by the troops. They rode the buses. They were behind the buses, in front of the buses, from Montgomery to the Mississippi state line. And when we got to the Mississippi state line, the Mississippi National Guard picked us up and escorted us to Jackson, to the Greyhound bus station there.
In fact, let's just fill in some of that latter stuff, because it'll be interesting for you as a group. We go to the station, and we had nothing in our way. We were sitting at the counters, the whole thing. It just seemed like it was like you would be there today, all right? So, and it seemed everything was all right. And then when we get ready to go, we had our tickets, whole thing. Looked like when we were ready to go, however, we go out to the bus, and there were white people on the bus. They had brought them up front. And when we got on, we go to the back, and then they take all the white people off of the bus. Then on comes the National Guard. And when the National Guard comes on, they have their guns, they're in full regalia, and Colonel, you see the pictures in the book. Is it General Graham, was it?
Graham.
Is it Graham? Okay. Because he and I had a confrontation later, right? So we get on the bus, and he starts it. Right after he starts it, after we get outside the city, he takes loose as we're going through the city, really, he takes loose the speedometer. And when we hit the highway, from that time on, it was straight, it was fast. We didn't know how fast we were going, but we were speeding through it. The interesting thing about it was that they wouldn't let us stop to go to the bathroom, which was an absolute need. I mean, we went for miles before you got to the state line. At the state line was when then the Mississippi state militia came up, right? Now, we had a time there when there were cars following us. Oh, there must have been 50 cars following us. They were all reporters. When we stopped there for the Alabama group to get off and the Mississippi group to come on, when we stopped there, they want to interview. Well, we all agreed that only one person would be answering questions, and that was Jim Lawson. And it was interesting because Jim told them everything about what we were doing, what it was really all about. We get there, and when the Life magazine came out the next week, it said asking for trouble and getting it. No understanding whatsoever of nonviolence. No understanding whatsoever of the conditions and the situation. Nothing that was important was spoken of. We go to we want to go on into Mississippi now.
Yes, we do. I just want to back up at one point.
Okay.
Because there was a very significant thing that happened at that mass meeting. We were there all night.
Yeah, that's right.
And they were negotiating to try to get, you know, some federal support and that sort of thing. So at any point, John, I'd like for you to give us that level of negotiations. Because a lot of things were happening. Well, one of the things I want to say about the mass meeting is that one of the most courageous things that I've ever seen in my life, out of all these things we've gone through, Martin Luther King mounted the pulpit and he said, I got a very important mission to complete. And he said, I just want a few, you know, men. But I want to make sure, you want to make sure that you are convinced about your nonviolence. Because this is a very important mission. And I remember he took a group of, now all the preachers didn't volunteer. You know, because some of them were not nonviolent. They were thinking about it. And some of them used to tell us, you know, he'd say, well, Jesus told Peter to put away your sword. And they were, you know, fundamental, literal interpreters, you know, of the Bible. You say, yeah, Reverend, he told you to put it away, not throw it away. Some of them still had their swords. But Martin Luther King took a group of ministers out that door in the face of that mob. I didn't know what was going on, but finally I figured, you know, what was happening. There were a group of cab drivers who had come together, and they were coming to arm themselves to come and rescue us. They had family members, you know, children, wives, mothers, you know, relatives in that church were surrounded by that mob. And, you know, they had not gone through nonviolent training. You know what I mean? The cab drivers was going to come, and that would have been a ready-made riot. So the National Guards, instead of coming to protect us, they would have been coming to put down, okay, these people. Martin Luther King not only walked through that mob with these ministers, and when they went out of that door, I said to myself, I don't think I'll ever see them again. So I said a little prayer, because we did a lot of praying that night. And then the miracle was they came back. I didn't expect them to come back. And I thought that was such an act of courage. Do you remember who those ministers were?
I wasn't there then.
That's right. Okay. But you remember when that happened, did you, John? You? Yeah. Okay. Now, I think that Jim wanted to...
I just wanted to add one more thing that I don't remember our talking about it, other than, John, you're mentioning how the press was attacked. And I think it's important that you realize, if you go back and you look in the history books, you're not going to find very many pictures of individuals actually being attacked. You see the after effects. The one exception was the picture from Birmingham. And it was the philosophy, if you will, of the Klan to intimidate the press to the point that you will not write, you will not film anything that jeopardizes a Klan member. You can take pictures afterwards, because that's going to intimidate the blacks, and that's going to intimidate anybody that comes down here. But I think that's a factor that a lot of people don't realize. It was the technique of the Klan to truly go against the media and make them do it the way they wanted it.
John, second call?
Jim.
Go ahead, John. Okay.
I think Jim is making a significant point here. So if you go back and just turn the pages of the history of what happened here, in Montgomery, there's very few, if any, video, still photograph of what actually happened. One of the most visible He says, Jim, and I think you're right. Never really thought about it like that. Because they destroyed, they intimidated. I remember the bureau chief from Time, and you all remember the guy, Bud somebody, who was just, who was based in Atlanta, that was here. And this guy, he's Calvin Trillin?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he would just blood was all over the place. But they had a picture of Jim and myself standing up against the wall. You saw the result.
Blood spatter.
Blood spatter on,
blood everywhere.
On our clothing.
Okay. John Sigmund, what was going on?
Right. Bernard asked what was the plan of the governor then. The truth about it was we never imagined that. Once we got the first wave of freedom fighters to New Orleans in that first afternoon, that there would be this second wave. And I had talked to the Attorney General about what to say to the governor if he finally agreed to see me. And I remember after I got to New Orleans, went to sleep in an airport near the motel. Before dawn the next morning, the Attorney General called me and woke me up. Told me there was a second wave of Freedom Riders, FBI knew, was coming down from Nashville. Said, you're from Nashville. The person directing them is Diane Nash. Do you know Diane Nash? Well, David Halberstam, I've been at his side many times. And said, sure, I know. I'm not sure how well she recognized me. I know. He said, we'll call her and tell her she's going to get somebody killed. Well, I thought about it, and I thought, you know, I really don't know her well enough. But I called my friend George Barrett and said, would you call her and see if you can soften her up and tell her I'm going to call her. Jim Lawson and I were at the Kennedy Library in Boston a couple of years ago when Diane was honored. And I heard her say, and I don't know to this day that she knows, and I was. She described the person who called as a man who seemed very arrogant. And I was the man calling from New Orleans. I was the man who was arrogant. You know, what were you, a junior at Fisk, maybe? Well, the conversation is as I remember it, is worth repeating because. Because, you know, my job was to tell her that she was about to get somebody killed. And I sort of eased into it, you know, this honey-dripping southern accent on this young woman from Chicago and try to persuade her. And like the tree standing by the water, she would not be moved. And I pushed, and my voice went up. And that's what, I mean, here is Representative President of the United States, Representative Attorney General of the United States, calling a young woman who's a junior at Fisk High, saying, do you understand what you are about to do? You are going to get somebody killed. And she said, sir, we all signed our wills last night. We understand this. And I called the Attorney General. He had said to me, well, who the hell is Diane Nash? And anyway, I headed back up there. We had no plan. The thing about the movement that I noted always, there was a strategy. I remember the confrontation with the mayor after the sit-ins. CT went in and leveled an indictment against the mayor and gave him the vinegar, and then Diane gave him the honey. Mayor, is it morally right to do this? And it worked. Well, we had no plan except to say, if we got to the governor, Governor, why don't we make this Mississippi's problem? Why don't we make Louisiana's problem? You know. Let's not have Aniston all over again. But it didn't work. He said he couldn't protect us. And John mentioned Mr. Mann. I mean, he was a man of great courage because when asked by the governor, he said, tell this man, tell this fellow We can't protect them. They're rabble rousers, they're troublemakers, they've come down here to get it, and they're going to get it. Right, Floyd? And I said a little earlier today, I looked across the table at Floyd, man, most of the governor's cabinet was there. And I looked at him, black hair, speckled with gray, sunburn, not a snaggle tooth. And I thought, redneck. So unfair, so unfair. He said, Governor, I've been a law enforcement man all my life. You tell me to protect them, they'll be protected. And that was the plan. After that, it was his strategy, as sort of a way out, to let Bull Connor protect in Birmingham. He would protect, Floyd Mann would protect on the highway. And Commissioner Sullivan's police would protect them here. And of course, whatever else happened, Commissioner Sullivan's word turned out to be worth nothing. And Diane mentioned the fact that I was hurt. John talked about the young white woman in the cab.
Yes.
I circled the block. I came by car, and as I circled that parking lot, it was a teeming anthill of violence. Jim says maybe 1,000 people. God knows I couldn't begin to count them. But as I came down far side, these two young white students, women, were being battered. One of them, Susan Wilbur, particularly bad. And I thought for just a minute I could get them out of there quickly, and I bumped up on the curb, blew the horn, jumped out, yelled at Susan Herman to get in the back of the car. I didn't know either one of them. I reached around and grabbed Susan Wilburn, brought her around to the driver's side. At the last minute, she resisted, said, sir, I don't want you to get hurt. I'm trained to take this. And she was bleeding from the nostrils at that time. That was a young guy in front of her punching her in the face, and a woman with a pocketbook hitting her over the head. And I couldn't tell whether Susan or the other young woman, and I yelled at her. At any rate, at the last minute, Susan Wilbur put her hands on the door jamb and said, Mr., I don't want you to get hurt. I can take this. I'm prepared to take it. And in I won't repeat the profanity that came from my mouth in these hallowed precincts, but I did say, get your in the car. And at that moment, these people wheeled me around and said, who are you? And I spoke those magic words, get back. I'm a federal man. And I turned back to her, and that's when I got it with a fight there.
I'm here to help you.
Yeah, I'm from the federal government. I'm here to help you.
Okay. And that's the... go ahead. Sure, go ahead.
See, I have solid back of the Nashville student movement and the Nashville movement also. And we had made definite decisions. So when I spoke, I could speak with authority because I was speaking on behalf of the Nashville movement. So I can act big and bad sometimes. But it wasn't just me, it was the solidarity of the movement, and there was no question. The Kennedy administration, and incidentally that was somebody in Washington that I was talking to, that I found very frustrating because he kept telling me that I did not understand that people were going to be killed, and I would tell him I do understand, and no matter how I would say it, and the fact that people had given me, since I was coordinator, sealed letters to be mailed in the event of their death. Oh, that's too emotional.
No, that's important.
But to finish up, the Kennedy administration throughout was always trying to get us to stop and, calling for cooling off periods and what have you. So when it came to groups that made decisions all along the way, I could afford to be very staunch because I knew the sentiment and the spirit of the Nashville group, and I was representing them.
Some people want to know who were the other top people that, because I suspect, we haven't talked about this, Diane, that you had to probably do a little pushing to convince them that we should go ahead as well. Why don't you tell us what really happened in the negotiation? And who were the big five that I was talking about? You know, you mentioned Dr. King, you mentioned James Farmer, and John was there. Who else was there?
There were representatives from the Congress of Racial Equality.
Right.
And somebody from SNCC, Jim Farmer.
Right.
Yeah, and myself.
Yeah. What was that conversation like when y'all talking about continuing the field lines?
Well, when questions would come up, I'd resolve them because I'd say, well, the Nashville movement is going.
Oh.
So
oh, I see.
There were not problems.
Okay. We're going to have to make a little shift now, but we're going to pick up on all of these details on our way back as well. But there was another topic which we want to quickly cover and just get some quick responses before we go, because I think our time is out. We only have 30 seconds. But in the movement, yeah, I know. Okay. The question was, what about reconciliation? And what was that like? I'd like to take a first cut at it, and if the rest of you can comment on as well. The entire process was reconciliation. At every point along the way, we were always open to our opponents changing. So therefore, the end was reconciliation, but the process was reconciliation. And we believe that the end must always pre-exist in the means. That's why our actions in response to all of the violence that we faced was also a reconciliatory approach to that response. One is that we felt that we were determined, last words of Diane, that we are going anyway, okay? Because it's the right thing to do. And no matter what happens, we are going. But the way we are going, though, is with love, compassion, and hope and determination that they would also join us. We're not trying to push anybody aside or push anybody down or wipe out anybody, okay? We wanted to wipe out hatred. We wanted to wipe out prejudice. We wanted to wipe out violence. So therefore, we had to be what we say we were trying to accomplish. So the reconciliation part, finally, and I think that one of the statements made that George Wallace, you know, came and apologized and about what happened. And my own comment is that that's good for us to have a healing of the spirits in our hearts. But more importantly is that we must also have a healing of the economic suffering that people have experienced, the political exploitation. So that's the healing part. The first part is the heart. But the second part has to be the healing that must take place. So that's why Martin Luther King went to march on Washington in the first place. It wasn't about a dream, it was about some, you know, a bad check. Our 40 acres and our mule. And I know where my 40 acres is, it's on Wall Street. You understand me? That's my 40 acres, I haven't gotten it yet. But the reconciliation part, you know, I'd like for some other people to comment on that before we leave as well.
The idea, though, is that whether your thing works or not depends upon whether you're really reconciled, right? Because the end result is not to keep the action going. End result is to stop it. reconciliation is necessary and hopefully the next step, right? But I want to tell you a story about Wallace that goes with the fact that he came to this church and asked for forgiveness. We did a 5-year march from Selma to Montgomery, and then we did a 10-year march from Selma to Montgomery. And the that 10-year march, Wallace asked, I think he counted out, 8 or 10 of us, to would we meet him in his office? And so we did. And he had several people there from his group as well, so that it could be a sort of like a fellowship meeting. When I walked into his office, his desk was like this across, and there was a conference table that went straight out from it. He had been shot. He didn't, you know, he had to move around quite a different way. So he had his office arrangement quite different, so he did not have to move from where he was or the many meetings that he had into his $12. I immediately noticed where I was going to sit, because in Chicago I had an office I set up the same way, so that I might need to imagine. Oh yeah. Preachers think they always heard in the church. I know better than to say I'll repeat. when I went into his office, because I had an office like it at one time in Chicago, I realized I wanted to sit right where the conference table met his desk, right? Because I'd be right at him, looking him in the eye. I wanted to see what I really thought about what the man was going to say, and be able to understand it, not only with my mind, but with a deeper understanding. I sat there, we went through this very nice thing. It was a very nice meeting. The man was sincere, people moved around. I stood up immediately when the program ended, and 3 other people immediately came around us there, around right there. So there were 4 of us right around him, and we asked 2 or 3 questions, and then got down to the real question. Would you do it again? And he looked at the fellow who asked him, and then he dropped his head, and he pointed up, and he said, no, because we all want to go up there. It was a religious matter in the final analysis. Same as Diane asked the mayor of Nashville, the moral question. It must be understood that we were a moral and spiritual movement. We were not a political movement. You have to understand that our hopes, our dreams, what we were looking for was far beyond a new law or a new piece of paper, right? It was not legal, it was moral and spiritual. You do the legal in the process, right? But you don't end there. And the success to me was that very fact that the man really said he wanted to go up there. There were other things that happened later that point to that same thing, that he was serious about the desire to reconcile. And I love to talk about that, because it proves that what we were really after came to be a fact.
Bernard, add a point here, which I think is very much in keeping with the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. You know, Dr. King used to say from time to time, hate is too heavy a burden to bear. And I think many of us in our movement, in our journey toward accepting nonviolence as a way of life, as a way of living, came to that point that you're not going to hate. You're not going to become bitter or hostile. I think I said on our bus And from time to time, you have to have what I call an executive session with yourself. Just don't talk back to yourself. You make up your mind that you may be beaten, you may get arrested and go to jail, you may be left for dead, but you're not going to hate. And you're not going to have any ill feelings or bitterness toward the person. People ask me, some of my colleagues ask me, why you don't have any malice or hatred toward the people? You don't have time to hate. And one of the points I tried to make, and I think Jim maybe taught us this, whether it was Governor Wallace or Bull Connor in Birmingham or Sheriff Clark in Selma, they didn't come in the world that way. There was somebody, innocent little baby, somebody, innocent little child, and something went wrong, whether it was the environment or whether people are taught to hate, to put down someone because of their race, their color, their religion, or sexual orientation, or whatever. You go back, hate is too heavy a burden to bear. I remember meeting with Governor Wallace once in 1979 during the Carter administration. Here in his office at Troy State, the office they had at Troy State. He heard that I was coming to Alabama to visit my family in Troy, and he invited me to come by. It was one-on-one. It was like a confession, like someone, I guess, is meeting with their minister, their priest, and he literally poured out his heart. See, I don't believe whether, sometimes I said to Bernard, I'm not so sure Governor Wallace ever believed all this stuff he was preaching. He was a politician, and he wanted to get ahead. And I asked him, I said, Governor, why didn't you give the order to the troops to beat us on the bridge in 1965. He said, John, I wanted you all to be stopped on the Selma side of the bridge because there were people waiting on the other side to kill you. I said, Governor, do you kill people to keep other people from killing them? And he couldn't give me an answer. But all these years later, I don't have any bitterness or ill feeling toward Governor Wallace or members of the Klan that beat us here, or Bull Connor who left us out on the highway. We wanted to make and build a sense of community, because we all were victims of a vicious and evil system. We all had to change that system. Hate is too heavy a burden to bear. It is better to build a sense of community with the power of love and forgiveness and be reconciled to each other.
On that note, we're going to thank you. And at some point, we're going to continue either on the bus or Birmingham someplace. And I think the next session we start out on, we're going to start out with questions. Okay? So you get all your questions written down now so we can do that. Okay? All right. Thank you.